I Believe by Tuesday, Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 4. Algernon awakened in the morning to bright sunshine and the sounds of birds singing in the branches of trees. Bright sunshine? Algernon remembered, with a start, that this was not sunshine. Here there was no sun. The air itself was alive. He pushed aside the coverlet and swung his feet out onto the floor and walked to the window. Outside, everything was as bright and as cheerful as it had been yesterday. Was it yesterday? Algernon was completely disoriented. He did not know if there were days or nights. There seemed to be no record of the passing of time. He went back to his bed and lay down upon the coverlet with his hands at the back of his head while he thought of all that had happened. Again there came a discreet knock at the door, and at his bidding a man entered. A very serious-looking man, one who appeared most thoroughly to know his duties. "I have come to talk to you," he said, "because we fear that you are in grave doubt as to the reality of what you are experiencing." Algernon put his hands by his side, and with his military training he almost lay to attention, as though he were in a military hospital. "Everything I have seen, sir," he said, "contradicts the teachings of the Christian Church. I expected to be met by angels. I expected them to be playing harps. I expected to see pearly gates and cherubim, but instead I find that the place might well be a glorified green park or Hyde Park or some other well-kept park. I might also," he said, "have been experiencing hallucinations in Richmond Park." The new doctor laughed and said, "Well, you're not a particularly strong Christian. If you had believed, let us say, a Roman Catholic, and you really believed in your religion, then you would have seen angels when you came here, and you would have seen those angels until the falsity of their appearance made you, instead, realize that they were but phantoms of your imagination. But here we deal in reality, because you are an experienced man of the world, because you have been a soldier and have seen death as well as life, you could see us as we really are." Algernon thought of some of the scenes from his past. "Death," he said, "I am most intrigued by this matter, because death is such a thing of terror on earth. People are desperately afraid to die. And a matter which has always amused me greatly is that the more religious a person, the more greatly they feel terror at even the thought of death." He smiled and clasped his hands and continued, "I have a very revered friend, a most ardent Catholic, who, whenever he hears that a person is ill and near death, will always say how glad he is that poor Mr. So-and-so is getting better and is in such good health." "But tell me, sir," said Algernon, "why is it that if there is life after death, that people fear death?" The doctor smiled at him rather quizzically and said, "Well, I should have thought that a man of your education and experience and perceptions would have realized the answer. As obviously you have not, let me explain. People go to Earth to accomplish certain things, to learn certain things, to experience certain hardships that the spirit or soul or overself, call it what you will, may be purified and strengthened thereby. So if a person commits suicide, then it's a crime against the program, against the plan of things. And if people saw how natural death is, and how it is just birth into another stage of evolution, then they would be wanting to die all over the place, and the whole purpose of Earth and other worlds would be lost. Certainly this was a new thought to Algernon, although, indeed, a logical one. But still, he was not satisfied. Then am I to understand that the fear of death is artificially induced and is wholly illogical? He asked. Yes, indeed, said the doctor. It is a provision of nature that everyone shall fear death. Everyone shall do everything they can to preserve life, so that the experiences on the earth may be maintained and carried through to their logical and predetermined results. So if a person commits suicide, then they are throwing everything out of gear. Mind you, he said, when the time for a natural death comes, there is normally no fear. There's normally no pain, because people in another realm of the astral can say when a person is due to die, or, as we prefer, undergo transition. And as that time approaches, a form of anesthesia is generated, and instead of the pangs of death, there are pleasant thoughts, thoughts of release, thoughts of going home. Algernon started up in some indignation. Oh, but that cannot be, he said. For people who are dying often twitch and thrash about and are obviously in very great pain indeed. The doctor shook his head sadly. No, no, he said, you are in error. When the person is dying, there is no pain, but release from pain. The body may twitch, the body may groan, but that is merely an automatic reaction from certain stimulated nerves. It does not at all mean that the person is enduring pain. The onlooker usually is no judge of what is going on. The conscious part, which is about to undergo transition, is divorced from the physical part, which is the mere animal being. So, wait, he said, when you committed suicide, you felt no pain, did you? Algernon rubbed his chin deep in thought, and then he replied hesitantly, well, no, I suppose I did not. I cannot remember having felt anything except an extremely cold sensation, and then nothing more. No, sir, perhaps you're right, come to think of it, no. I did not feel any pain. I felt bemused. I felt wondering. The doctor laughed and wrung his hands, saying, now I have you. You admit you felt no pain, and yet you were screaming like a stuck pig. And, by the way, with a stuck pig, all you get is the air in the lungs being expelled rapidly and agitating the vocal cords so that one gets a high-pitched squeal. There was the same sort of reaction with you, a long, high-pitched squeal interrupted by the bubbling of your blood as it emerged copiously from the slash in your throat. It was the high-pitched squeal which brought the unfortunate serving maid into the bathroom. Yeah, it seemed logical enough now. Algernon was beginning to see that this was not hallucination, but fact, and then he said, "But I understood that when a person died, he would immediately be taken before God to be judged. He would immediately see Jesus and perhaps the Holy Mother and the disciples." The doctor shook his head sadly and replied, "But you say you thought you would see Jesus. Supposing you'd been a Jew? Supposing you'd been a Muslim? Supposing you'd been a Buddhist? Would you still expect to see Jesus? Or do you think that in heaven the place is divided up into separate countries where people of each religion go? No, the whole idea is absurd. Nonsense, criminal folly, and foolish preachers on earth really pollute the population with their horrendous legends. People come here and they think they are in hell. There is no hell except earth." Algernon really jumped. He felt his body twitch as though on fire. "Oh, then am I in heaven?" he asked. "No, indeed not," replied the doctor. "There's no such place. There is no heaven, and there is no hell. But there is purgatory. Purgatory is a place where you purge your sins, and that is what you're doing here. Here you will shortly be met by a committee who will help you to decide what you are going to do when you return to Earth. You have to return to Earth to live out the plan which you yourself made. And actually, that is why I came here now, to see if you're ready to be presented before the committee." Algernon felt a twinge of fear. He felt as though icy fingers were going up his spine. It sounded worse than an army medical board in which doctors probed and prodded and asked the most embarrassing question about one's reactions to this and that and how one was going to manage about a sex life and was he married, did he have a girlfriend? No, Algernon could not summon any enthusiasm whatever for going before the board of... what? "Well," he said, "surely I am to be given time to recover somewhat from the extreme trauma of passing over from life to this. Admitted that I came here of my own volition through committing suicide, which appears to be such a heinous crime, but I still think I should be given some time to recover and see what I want to do. And while I'm on the subject," he said, "how can suicide be such a heinous crime if people do not know that they are committing a crime? I always understood that if a person was not conscious of doing ill, then he could not be punished for doing so." "Oh, nonsense," exclaimed the doctor. "You are like all those of your ilk who think that because you come of a higher class, you're entitled to special consideration. You always try to rationalize. It seems to be a vice of your type. You knew perfectly well that it was wrong to commit suicide. Even your own peculiar form of religion, as taught down there, instills in you that self-destruction is a crime against the person, against the state, and against the church. Algernon looked frightfully sour and said, "Then how do you account for Japanese who commit suicide if things go wrong with them? If a Japanese man thinks he's lost face, then he disembowels himself publicly. That's suicide, isn't it? He's doing what he believes, isn't he?" The doctor looked most distressed and replied, "It does not alter the matter in the slightest that it has become a social custom in Japan to destroy oneself rather than face embarrassment. Let me tell you, let me get this rammed into your subconscious. Suicide is never right. Suicide is always a crime. There are never any extenuating circumstances for committing suicide. It means that a person is not evolved enough to continue that which they took on of their own volition. But let us not waste any more time. You're not here for a holiday. You're here so that we may help you make the most of your forthcoming life on Earth. Come on." He rose abruptly and stood over Algernon, who bleated plaintively, "Well, don't I get a chance to have a bath? Don't I have any breakfast before I am dragged away?" "Bosh!" exclaimed the doctor in irritation. "Here you do not need a bath, and here you do not need food. You are cleansed and fed by the atmosphere itself. You are beggaring the question because you appear to be not much of a man, just one who tries to evade all his responsibilities. Come with me." The doctor turned and made for the door. Very, very reluctantly, indeed, Algernon rose slowly to his feet and followed him. The doctor led the way out. They turned to the right and entered a garden which Algernon had not previously seen. The atmosphere was wonderful. There were birds in the air and many pleasant animals lying around, and then, as the doctor and Algernon turned a corner, there appeared another building. It looked as though it were a cathedral. There were spires to it, and this time, instead of a ramp going up, there were many, many steps. They climbed the steps and went into the cool recesses of a mighty building. Many people occupied the entrance. There were people sitting on comfortable benches around the walls. Again, in the center of the vestibule, there was what seemed to be a reception desk, circular as before, but this time it was staffed by much older people. The doctor led Algernon up and said, "We have come to go before the council." One of the assistants rose to his feet and said, "Please follow me." With the assistant leading the way, the doctor and Algernon followed. After a short walk down a corridor, they turned left into an anteroom. The assistant said, "Wait here, please," while he continued and knocked on a door and entered when bidden to do so. The door closed behind him, and there could be heard the very faint murmur of voices. Some moments later, the assistant came out again and held the door open, saying, "You may enter now." The doctor jumped to his feet and took Algernon by the arm and led him in. Involuntarily, Algernon stopped in astonishment when he entered the room. It was a very large room indeed, and in the center there was a globe slowly turning, a globe with blues and greens. Instinctively, Algernon knew that this was a simulacrum of the earth. He was both fascinated and intrigued to see that the earth globe was turning, turning without visible means of support. He seemed to be in space, gazing down upon the earth, which was illuminated by some unseen sun. There was a long table, very highly polished, very intricately carved, and at one end of the table a very old man was sitting, white-haired, white-bearded. He looked benign, but yet at the same time he gave an impression of sternness. He gave the impression that should the occasion warrant it, he could be a very tough person indeed. Algernon took a fleeting glance, and there seemed to be eight other people sitting at the table. Four were men, and four were women. The doctor led him to a seat at the foot of the table. The table, Algernon saw, was so arranged, so shaped, that the other members could all see him without even turning in their chairs, and briefly he wondered at the craftsmanship which could have worked out such intricate geometry. The doctor said, "This is Algernon St. Clair de Bonkers. We have determined that he has reached a state of recovery which will enable him to profit by your advice. I present to you Algernon St. Clair de Bonkers." The old man at the head of the table nodded briefly for them to sit down, and then he said, "Algernon St. Clair de Bonkers, you are here because you have committed the crime of suicide. You killed yourself in spite of the plans you had made and in defiance of higher law. Do you wish to say anything in your defense first?" Algernon cleared his throat and shivered. The doctor leaned across and whispered, "Stand up." Reluctantly, Algernon got to his feet and said rather defiantly, "If I made an arrangement to do a certain task, and if conditions not of my choosing made it impossible for me to do that task, then surely, my life being my own, I have every right to terminate it if I so choose. I did not decide to come to this place. I decided merely to terminate my life." So saying, he sat down with a defiant thump. The doctor looked at him sadly. The old man at the head of the table looked at him with great sorrow, and the four men and four women looked at him with compassion, as if they had heard it all before. Then the old man said, "You made your plan, but your life is not your own. Your life belongs to your over-self, that which you call your soul, and you have injured your over-self by your recalcitrance and by your foolish method of depriving your over-self of its puppet. Because of this, you will have to return to earth and live a whole life again, and this time be sure you do not commit suicide. Now, we have to decide the best time for you to return, and the best type of conditions for you, and to find suitable parents." There was considerable rustling of papers, and one member rose from his seat and moved closer to the globe. For some moments he stood there looking at the globe, but saying nothing. Then, still silent, he moved back to his place at the side of the table and made a notation on his papers. "Algernon," said the old man, "you went down to earth in conditions of great comfort. You went down to an old, established family where all your creature comforts were attended to. You had every possible consideration. Money was no object. Your education was of the very best obtainable in your country. But have you thought of the harm that you have done in your life? Have you thought of the brutality? Have you thought of how you used to strike servants? Have you thought of the young maid servants you have seduced?" Algernon jumped to his feet in indignation. "Sir," he exclaimed heatedly, "I was always told that the maidservants were there for an unmarried son's convenience, to be his playthings, to learn about sex. I have done no wrong, no matter how many maidservants I have seduced." He sat down, fairly seething with indignation. "Algernon, you know better," said the old man. "You know yourself. That class, as you believe in it, is merely an artificial thing. On your world, if a person has money or comes from an old family which has been favored, then they have a lot of concessions. Whereas, if a person is poor and has to work for one of those other families, they are denied concessions and treated as inferior creatures. You know the law as well as anyone, for you have lived many times, and you have all this knowledge within your subconsciousness." One of the women, sitting at the table, pursed her lips as though she had just tasted an extremely sour gooseberry, and she said primly, "I wish to put on record my opinion that this young man should restart his life as one of the underprivileged. He has had everything his own way. I think he should start again as the son of a lesser tradesman, or even the son of a cowherd." Algernon jumped to his feet in fury. "How dare you say things like that?" he shouted. "Do you know that blue blood runs in my veins? Do you know that my ancestors went on the Crusades? My family is one of the most respected families." He was interrupted in midstream of his speech, as it were, by the elderly chairman, who said, "Now, now, let us not have arguments here. It will not do you any good at all. It will merely add to the load which you have to bear. We are trying to help you, not to add to your karma, but to help you to lessen it." Algernon broke in truculently, "Well, I am not having anyone say things about my forebears. I suppose yours came from brothel keepers or whorehouse managers or something. Pah!" The doctor firmly grasped Algernon's arm and pulled him down into the chair, saying, "Be quiet, you clown. You're making things so much worse for yourself. You don't know the first thing about this place yet. Keep quiet and hear what is said." Algernon subsided with the thought that he was indeed in purgatory, as he'd already been told. But then he listened to the chairman, who said, "Algernon, you are treating us as though we were your enemies. Such is not the case. You are not here as an honored guest, you know. You're here as one who has committed a crime. And before we go any further in this matter, there is one thing I want to make clear. There is no such thing as blue blood in one's veins. There's no such thing as inheriting class, or caste, or status. You've been brainwashed. You are bemused by the legends and fairy tales that you've been told." He stopped for a moment to take a sip of water, and then he looked at the other members of the board before continuing. "You must have in your mind the definite thought that entities from many, many worlds, from many, many planes of existence, go down to Earth, one of the lowest of the worlds, to learn by hardship that which they seem incapable of learning by kindness. And when one goes down to the Earth, one adopts the body most suited for the fulfillment of one's task. If you were an actor, you would realize that you're just a man, the actor, and you may be called upon to play many, many parts in a lifetime. So, during a lifetime, as an actor, you may have to dress as a prince or a king or a beggar. As a king, you may have to pretend that you are of the blood royal, but it is pretense only. Everyone in the theater really knows that. Some actors get carried away so much, as you have, that they really believe they are princes or kings, but they never want to be beggars. Now, no matter who you are, no matter how high your degree of evolution, when you come here, it is because you have committed the crime, and indeed a crime it is, of suicide. You come here so that you can atone for your crime. You come here so that we, in touch with higher planes, and also in touch with the earth itself, can suggest how best that atonement may be fulfilled." Algernon did not look happy at all. "Well, how did I know it was wrong to commit suicide? And what are you going to say about the Japanese who commit suicide for honor?" he asked, still with considerable truculence. The chairman said, "Suicide is never the correct thing to do. It is not even correct when Buddhist priests or Shinto priests set themselves on fire or disembowel themselves or throw themselves off cliff tops. Man-made laws can never override the laws of the universe. But listen to me." The chairman looked down at his papers and said, "You were going to live until you were a certain age, and you ended your life on Earth 30 years before that age, and thus it is that you have to return to Earth to live 30 years and then die to the Earth, and the two lives, the one which you terminated and the one to which you are now going, will merely count as one, what shall I call it? Let us call it a class session." Another of the women fluttered a hand to attract the chairman's notice. "Yes, madam," he queried, "you have a comment?" "Yes, I do, sir," she said. "I think the young man doesn't at all realize his position. He thinks he is so terribly superior to everyone else. I think perhaps he should be told of the deaths he has caused. I think he should be told more of his past." "Yes, yes, but as you are so very well aware, he's going to see his past in the Hall of Memories," said the somewhat irritated chairman. "But, Mr. Chairman," said the woman, "the Hall of Memories interlude comes after, and we want this young man to listen to us now, sanely, if such a thing is possible in such a young man," she said, darting a glance at Algernon. "I think that he should be told more of his position now." The chairman sighed and shrugged his shoulders and said, "Very well, as it is your wish, we will alter our routine, and I suggest that we take the young man to the Hall of Memories now, so that he can see what makes us less than enamored of his self-styled attainments." There was a shuffling of chairs as they were pushed back, and the members of the board rose to their feet. The doctor also rose in some dismay and said, "Come on, you've asked for it," to Algernon. Algernon looked quite indignantly from one to the other, and he rasped, "Well, I didn't ask to come to this place. I don't know what you're all making such a commotion for. If I have to get back to Earth, then let me get back to it and get on with it." The chairman said, "We will now accompany you to the Hall of Memories, and there you will be able to judge whether we are exceeding our authority, as you seem to imagine, or whether we are being lenient. Come." So saying, he turned and led the way out of the large chamber and into the open again. It was so refreshing out in the open. The living atmosphere, the birds and the friendly bees which went buzzing by. Here there were no insects to bite or to pester, but only insects which added what one might term a familiar music to the surroundings. The chairman and the other members of the board led the way, almost like a school treat, thought Algernon, except that it's no treat for me. And then he glanced sideways at the doctor and said, "It seems that you are my jailer, eh?" The doctor did not reply. Instead, he just grasped Algernon's arm more firmly. And together they walked on. Soon they came to another building. Algernon at first sight exclaimed, "Oh, the Albert Hall! How did we get back in London?" The doctor laughed. He was really amused. "This is not Albert Hall. Look at the difference in architecture. This place is beautiful." Together they entered the hall, and it was, as the doctor had said, beautiful. The chairman led the way into some inner recesses. Algernon guessed from the time that they were walking that they must be right in the heart of the building. Then a door was opened, and Algernon gasped and drew back in such a hurry that he bumped into the doctor, who laughed and said, "Oh, no, this is not the edge of the universe. You can't fall. It's perfectly normal. Just compose yourself. There's nothing dangerous going to happen." The chairman turned to Algernon and said, "Walk forward, young man. Walk forward, and you will know when to stop and pay great attention." For a moment, Algernon stood stock still, really frightened that he was going to fall over the edge of the universe and tumble down along the stars at his feet. Then a very firm push in the small of his back propelled him forwards, and having started, he found he couldn't stop. Algernon walked forward, propelled by some force beyond his knowing. He moved, and as he did so, shadows, forms, and colors slid by him, shadows becoming more solid until, in the end, there was a definite obstruction. He came to a dead stop, again of no volition of his own. He looked about him in some confusion, and then a voice said, "Enter." Again, through no conscious effort on his part, Algernon moved forward, and through what seemed to be an impenetrable wall. There was a terrible, traumatic feeling of falling. Then Algernon seemed to be disembodied. He was looking down at a scene. A nurse was holding out a baby which had just been delivered of his mother. A fierce-looking gentleman was looking down at the baby, and then suddenly he twirled his mustache and said to the nurse, "Horrible little creature, isn't it? Looks more like a drowned rat than what I hope will be a man." "All right, nurse, take him away." The scene swirled, and then Algernon saw himself in a classroom being taught by a tutor. He saw himself playing rather mean tricks on the tutor, who could not say much about it because Algernon's father was an extremely autocratic aristocrat who regarded tutors and governesses and all employed people as menials beneath contempt. Algernon looked down with horror at some of the things he had done, things which made him blush now. Then the picture changed again. He was older now, perhaps 14. He guessed himself to be between 14 and 15, and then he saw himself looking somewhat furtively out of a doorway in what was a fairly deserted part of the family manor. A pretty young maid servant came along, and Algernon ducked back, but as she passed the door he leapt out, grabbed her round the throat, dragging her into the room. Quickly he locked the door, and, still holding the maidservant by her throat to stop her from screaming, he ripped off her clothing. Algernon grew hot at the thought of what he had done. Then again the scene changed. He was standing in his father's study. The weeping maidservant was standing there as well. Algernon's father was twirling his mustache and listening to what the girl had to say, and then he laughed harshly, and he said, "My good heavens, woman, don't you understand that a young gentleman has to find out about sex? Why do you think you're here? If you cannot accept a little thing like that, get out of my house." Imperiously he raised his hand and slapped the girl across the face. She turned and ran weeping from the room. The father turned to Algernon and said, "So you've been blooded, young man. You're no longer a virgin, eh? Well, keep up the good work, get in your practice. I want to see many strong sons born to this house before I depart this world." So saying, the father dismissed Algernon at a gesture. The picture changed, and changed again. Eton, rowing on the river. Oxford, the army, drilling men and then overseas, war against the Boers. Algernon looked with horror at the pictures. He saw himself giving orders to his men to mow down a defenseless, frightened family who did nothing but fail to understand an order in English because they spoke only Afrikaner. He saw the bodies flung in the ditch at the side of the road, and he saw himself laughing callously as a young girl was speared through the abdomen with a bayonet and tossed aside. The pictures continued. Algernon was bathed in cold perspiration. He felt sick. He felt the most urgent desire to vomit, but could not. He saw the total of deaths mount. 70, 74, 78. 78 deaths. And then, just as he was going to kill the 79th, another man, a sniper, rose up and shot Algernon, so that he was no longer a man. The pictures went on until they seemed to have no more meaning for Algernon. He reeled away and leaned against a wall, and then, without knowing how, without having made a movement of his own volition, he found himself again in the company of the doctor and members of the board. They looked at him quizzically, and then, for a moment, a flicker of compassion crossed the face of the chairman, but he merely said, "Well, let's get back to our discussion." He turned and led the way out of the Hall of Memories and back to the boardroom. Again, in the room, the chairman said, "You have seen incidents of your life, and you've seen that, blue blood or red blood, you have committed many crimes, ending up by the crime of suicide. Now, we have to decide, or rather we have to help you to decide, what will be the best vocation by which you can atone for the harm that you've done in the viciousness of war and the crime which you have committed in suicide. Do you have any ideas what you'd like to be?" Algernon was very chastened. He felt very shaky. He felt worse than he could ever remember feeling before. He took his head in his hands and leaned his elbows on the table. The room was silent, completely silent. Algernon sat there for an indefinite time, thinking of all that he had seen. Worse, thinking of all the things that he had seen, of the acts which he had done. And he pondered, what should he be? The thought occurred to him that possibly he should become a priest, a clergyman, possibly a bishop. And, with a bit of influence, he might even rise to be an archbishop. But then, from somewhere, he got such an impelling feeling of negation that he changed his line of thinking very quickly. "A veterinarian," he thought. But no, he did not like animals that much, and there wasn't much status in being a veterinarian, was there? It would be such a come-down, he thought, to one of his caste, to be a mere veterinarian. From somewhere he got the impression of silent laughter, laughter which mocked him. Laughter which indicated to him that he was still on the wrong track. And then he thought he would become a doctor, a fashionable doctor. He would work among the nobility, and possibly he could save 70 or 80 lives in his career, and then he would have a clean sheet with which to start another life at the end of this one, the impending one. One of the men spoke for the first time. "We have, of course, been watching your thoughts in this globe," and he gestured to a globe let in to the table, which Algernon had not seen before, because it had been covered up, but now it was glowing and showing Algernon's thoughts. As Algernon blushed deeply at the realization that all he had thought had been revealed, so the image in the globe blushed deeply also. The chairman spoke. "Yes, I can thoroughly recommend that you become a doctor, but I do not at all recommend that you become a society doctor. This is the plan which I would recommend in your case. You have taken life. You have maimed and you have mutilated others." Algernon rose to his feet. "No, I have not maimed. I have not mutilated." The chairman interrupted. "Yes, by your orders, others have been killed. Others have been maimed and mutilated, and you bear the blame quite as much as the person who actually did the acts. But you are listening to me, and you had better listen carefully, for I shall not repeat what I am saying. You should become a doctor, but a doctor in a poor district where you can work among the poor, and you will start your life under poor conditions, no longer a member of the aristocracy, but one who has to claw his way up. And in the 30th year of that life, your life will be ended, and you will return here if you repeat your suicide, or if not, you will go to a higher plane of the astral, where you will be prepared according to how well you have performed in the life which you are about to undergo." There was considerable discussion for some time, and then the chairman knocked with his gavel and said, "We will meet again to plan the parents you will have, to plan the area to which you will be born, and to arrange the date. Until that time, you may return to the house of rest. The meeting is now adjourned." Algernon and the doctor walked somberly along the garden paths, neither saying a word, and then the doctor took Algernon into the house of rest and showed him a suitable room, saying, "I will come back for you later when I am so instructed." With the briefest of nods, he turned away and left, and Algernon sat in a chair with his head in his hands, the picture of misery, thinking of all that he had seen, thinking of all that he had done, and thinking, "Well, if this is purgatory, thank goodness there is no hell." End of chapter 4.